Morning. I've been thinking about a couple of things lately in view of our politics in the United States and prejudice and polarization and Dogen, Buddhist teachings. So that's essentially what I want to talk about today. So I want to start with a little bit of a history lesson. And I read about, I don't know, several months ago, a book by John Meacham called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. And what he does is he goes through and he talks about various times in U.S. history when there is this kind of polarized, hate-filled response to things that are going on in the culture. And one of them was particularly interesting to me because I didn't know about it. And just in general, what I got out of this was that every 30 to 50 years in the United States, it's actually a fairly short amount of time, there's something, some movement that goes on that is similar to what we're experiencing right now in American politics. So the one that I found interesting, because I didn't know much about it, is something that happened in the 1920s in the United States. So there was this idea of what was called the 100% Americanism, which is similar to the kind of feeling of make America great that's going on right now. So there were some really interesting quotes that I thought could be applied to today. A journalist at the time wrote, "Innumerable patriotic societies have sprung up, each with have conjured up new and even greater menaces. Innumerable other gentlemen now discovered that they could defeat whatever they wanted to defeat by tarring it conspicuously with the Bolsheviks' brush. Big Navy men, believers in compulsory military service, anti-cigarette campaigners, anti-evolution fundamentalists, defenders of the moral order, book censors, Jew haters, Negro haters, landlords, manufacturers, utility executives, upholders of every sort of cause, good and bad and indifferent, all wrapped themselves in Old Glory and the mantle of the Founding Fathers and allied their opponents with Lenin." So that was a comment that was made about the 100% Americanism, which, by the way, there's a Wikipedia entry for this movement in the United States, which I thought was interesting. In 1920 in New York, there were five socialists who were elected to the state assembly, and the party decided, the state government, that it was unacceptable that they would be seated in their positions, although they had been duly elected. And so they were denied their seats in the state assembly. Also, it was considered that it was dangerous for the state assembly to have these kinds of people representing the government, and also that was also true in the United States in general. So the Massachusetts Springfield Republican newspaper wrote in an op-ed, "And when will it end? Shall we sometime see Republicans excluding Democrats and Democrats excluding Republicans from our lawmaking bodies on the ground that the other people's principles are inimical to the best interests of the United States? Every part has always thought that of their rivals, but it is something new in America for parties to translate the idea into action." So again, that was said in the 1920s. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote during this time, "In order to win, the South had to make Negroes into thieves, monsters, and idiots. Tomorrow we must make Latins, Southeastern Europeans, Turks, and other Asiatics into actual lesser breeds. Some seem to see today Antichrist in Catholicism and in Jews international plotters of the protocol, and in the rising tide of color, a threat to all civilizations and human culture. All of those statements we could apply to what's happening in our politics today. And this happened in the 1920s. These kinds of statements have been made over and over and over again, periodically, in the American cultural milieu and in our politics. Have you ever wondered why people stopped coming through Ellis Island? I just assumed that, I don't know, it had something to do with some kind of just shift in people's migration or whatever, but it turns out that the reason people stopped coming through Ellis Island is because of eugenics, which, by the way, if you don't know this already, was created in the United States during the early 1900s and 20s. And because of eugenics, they decided that Eastern Europeans and all the people who were coming over into Ellis Island were not appropriate stock for people in the United States. They weren't a good enough race, and they didn't want people, these races or groups of people, to taint the American genetic pool. And so they stopped and cut back the immigration that was coming into Ellis Island. It's an interesting documentary on this that Jocko and I saw that was on Channel 9. I think it's a Frontline. Showed that recently. The Espionage Act of 1917, which was repealed in 1920, and the Sedition Act of 1918, which is still in effect, made it a federal offense to, quote, use disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the Constitution, the government, the American uniform, or the flag. Over 2,100 people were prosecuted under these acts, and 74 newspapers were barred from using the U.S. mail to send out to their subscribers. So in 1920, not being able to send out a newspaper using the mail meant essentially your subscription base could only be people who were in a certain radius of your publication. These acts were aimed at socialists, pacifists, and anti-war activists during World War I, and later against communism, and helped further the career of J. Edgar Hoover. And the president during this time was Woodrow Wilson. On January 2nd in 1920, in a dragnet coordinated by the Justice Department, federal marshals and local police in 32 cities raided the homes of suspected radicals and headquarters of radical organizations without search warrants or arrest warrants. They arrested more than 4,000 people, of whom some 550 were deported, and ransacked homes and offices, seizing papers and records. During World War II, there was also a huge anti-German sentiment in this country. There were a lot of German immigrants in this country. These people were U.S. citizens of German descent, and they were hounded, and they were ostracized by their neighbors. They were put out of business, and some of them were arrested. Businesses changed their names because of this. Streets were renamed. And sauerkrauts, you may find this amusing, sauerkraut was renamed Liberty Cabbage. And hamburgers were called Liberty Sandwiches. And this kind of is reminiscent of what recently, French fry? Can't remember what, French fries? So here we have this astounding, to me, this astounding piece of history that wasn't that long ago. You know, about a kind of a crackdown on liberties in the United States. And we all know, many others, right, we know about the internment camps here in California and other states that I found out about when I moved to California. This wasn't part of my history lessons. Okay, so why? Why do I go through this litany of pretty scary stuff that happened in the past? I want to remind us that we have been here before and that we have corrected our course before and that this will not be the last time in all likelihood. This seems to be endemic to the human condition, that we get caught in our fear and our ignorance and our delusion. And when that happens, we start to do things that are pretty abhorrent to each other. And of course, right now, we're going through another period like that. So we know that Donald Trump has rekindled this kind of rhetoric towards immigrants, Democrats, the press, and by extension, this fear and hatred of Jews and Muslims, progressives, and anyone who does not share his views. These are exactly the same others that are trotted out over and over again in American politics. We've had Charlottesville, we've had anti-Muslim policies, we've had anti-LGBTQ policies, we've had anti-press as being called the enemy of the people, we've had bombs sent to primary people who are against Donald Trump, we had killings at the Tree of Life Temple most recently. Early in Donald Trump's run for office, he made fun of a disabled reporter. I mean, basically, you know, it's like he's just run the gambit. He calls for violence, and we can see the results of that. So, last night, Jocko and I, and Eileen was there, and Peg was there, and I don't know if anybody else was there. We went to Temple Bethel to Shabbat. To attend there and be in a solidarity with the Jewish community over what happened at the Tree of Life Synagogue. And what I found there was a group of people united in remembering and enacting love. I can't think of, in the United States and in our Western culture, I can't think of a group of people who have been more unjustly villainized and characterizes this, that, and the other thing, and persecuted than people of the Jewish faith. I mean, it's just all the way through history. And so to me, it's like I think this is a group of people who understand how to be resilient and respond this kind of treatment over and over and over again. And what I found at Temple Bethel is people were responding with love. People were responding with equanimity and this way of kindling hope and solidarity with each other and solidifying their understanding about what is an appropriate response to this kind of situation. We sang, the lyrics to a song we sang are, "Oh, sweet friends, come and dry your eyes and hold each other by this tree of life. I'm angry and tired of this great divide, but I sing nonetheless with love on our side." So I was struck by the decision, not for just last night, but also for all time, to respond to this historic prejudice of epic proportions with love, action, and compassion. The whole service resonated with this sentiment. And we know from our Jewish brothers and sisters' actions that this love is backed by political, social, and religious actions. This is not passive, indistinct, flaccid love. It is a passionate, dynamic, inspiring love. It is passionate and dynamic and inspiring. So Dogen wrote in Kuge, a fascicle in the Shobo Genzo, he said that our bodhisattva practice is born in fire. This bodhisattva practice is a blue lotus blooming in the fire of samsara. This world is the world of samsara. And this world is the reason that we have bodhisattva practice. Bodhisattva practice is not separate from the saha world. Bodhisattva practice is in response, in coordination to this saha world. So this world is not going to suddenly change where there is no conflict or prejudice. This world, in all likelihood, is going to continue to be just like this. So how do we respond to that? Because it is absolutely important that there is this response. that there is this bodhisattva response, no matter what you call it or what your religion is, that people keep the faith, if you will, that people continue to come back and do what needs to be done to support each other in our good and wholesome responses, to understand that we are not separate people. We live on a very small planet. We are all together, no matter what our color is or what our religion is, even what our political views are, that we are all together on this planet. So this sole function of the bodhisattva practice, this sole function of enlightened practice, is to benefit all beings. And of course our practice is, and this is why we study, for example, Shantideva, our practice is to say, how do I do that? How do I meet each situation in a way that is wholesome and good and appropriate? How do I meet a situation in which I take action in a way that is efficacious? So it's not just a matter of saying, oh, it's okay. Oh, you know, anything you do is fine because you're caught in the causes and conditions of your life. The reason we study those practices is because it teaches us equanimity so that we can respond in an appropriate way. We can respond in a way that's skillful and helpful. That's why we do this practice. That's why we study Shantideva. That's why we have the precepts. We say, what is right speech? Is right speech inflammatory speech? Our president, Donald Trump, says, oh, the things that I've said about violence, about lock her up, all those kinds of inflammatory language, it's not my fault that one person goes in and kills 11 people in a synagogue. It's not my fault that I'm engaged in inflammatory speech. Most of us don't have the forum for us to engage in those kinds of things the kind of speech that we do engage in that's not helpful, that has that kind of bully pulpit. But we all engage in and think thoughts that are not particularly helpful. We all get caught in our prejudices. So that's our job as bodhisattvas, to catch ourselves. That's our job as bodhisattvas. That's our job of waking up in the fire of samsara to say, what is it? What is it? What is the right thing to do here? I had this thought about somebody that was not very nice because of their gender or because of their age or because of their color. And then I catch myself and I say, no, I'm going to stop it here, right here, with this person, right now, in this place. Not in the abstract, but with me. So each one of us, that's our bodhisattva practice. Each one of us, with each other, in each moment, that we are doing our best to be the blue lotus blooming in fire. Tigan Layton said, he's the abbot of the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate in Chicago. Supposedly he recently remarked that engaged Buddhism was a misnomer because Mahayana Buddhism is at its heart about being engaged. Our practice is at its heart about being engaged. We are constantly engaged with dialogue with ourselves, constantly engaged with dialogue in the world. This is our practice. When I went to Shabbat last night, it's like, sisters and brothers, speak my mind. You know, I completely resonated with what was being said. I felt like I was in the midst of teachers and bodhisattvas, the whole congregation. You know, I was inspired by that to go and engage in and share that with the congregation at Temple Bethel, and that they were so open to having us there to share that experience. So please keep in mind that this is the long haul, you know? This is our life. This is our life. This is our vow. To make our best effort. To make our best effort. We need to keep up our spirits. We need to encourage each other. We need to follow the precepts. We need to make this life a koan of nonviolence and love. So Tuesday. So Tuesday we have an election. I trust that everyone here in this room is going to vote. If we are fearful, I am fearful. I am worried that the results will not be the results that I want the results to be. But regardless of what the results are, the work does not stop. And part of the work is keeping our spirits up. Part of the work is supporting each other. Part of the work is to be joyful if we can. To keep our humor, our sense of humor. Dogen wrote in the Genjo Koan, "The Buddha way is basically leaping clear of the many and the one. Thus there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. And yet, in attachment, blossoms fall, and in aversion, weeds spread. And yet." When we go into Buddhist practice, we often think, oh, it's going to be perfect. Enlightenment is about perfection. Enlightenment is about no conflict. Enlightenment somehow transcends this world. No more problems. Somehow I'll be in a body, but I won't be in a body. It'll all be good. But guess what? We live in the Saha world. Guess what? We're in bodies. Guess what? We have emotions. Guess what? We're going to die. Impermanence, impermanence, impermanence. And yet, in attachment, blossoms fall. And in aversion, weeds spread. This is why we study our Buddhist practice. This is why we learn about skillful means. We are warriors who live in the weeds and marvel at the falling blossoms, at the beauty of this world. In this shattered beauty called life, we endeavor to learn the Buddha's way in order to be the blue lotus blooming in the fire. Thank you.